Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Manuel Pastor, author of State of Resistance, What California's Dizzying Descent and Remarkable Resurgence Mean for America's Future. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. California has long been a bellwether of the country's progressive and reactionary politics. But the state that introduced us to Ronald Reagan and Harvey Milk has also confronted many of the challenges the rest of the country now faces decades before the rest of us. In the encore edition of Reader's Corner, we talk to sociologist Manuel Pastor. In his book, State of Resistance, Pastor describes the roller coaster of California politics, economy, culture over the past half century. Pastor makes the case for addressing generational and racial differences and renewing our commitment to public investment and community organizing, with California leading the charge. Dr. Manuel Pastor is a professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California, where he also serves as director of the Program for Environmental and Regional Equity and is co-director of USC's Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration. Dr. Pastor has received Guggenheim and Fulbright Fellowships, as well as the 2012 Wally Marks Changemaker of the Year Award from the Liberty Hill Foundation in Los Angeles. Dr. Pastor, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Glad to be with you.
What is it about California? In your first chapter, you talk about California is America fast forward. Help us understand that.
Well, in many ways, California is America just sooner. The demographic change, for example, in California between 1980 and 2000, in which we went from being about two-thirds non-Hispanic white to about 47% non-Hispanic white and therefore majority people of color, that demographic change over that 20 years is basically what the United States is going through between the year 2000 and 2050. And part of what prompted the book, of course, was seeing the 2016 election of Donald Trump as having echoes of what happened in California in the early 1990s. In 1994, California voters passed Proposition 187, a proposition that sought to strip social services and even educational services from undocumented immigrants. So much like the sort of anti-immigrant or immigrant anxiety that was prevalent in 2016 and even today, this was prevalent in California in the 90s. But what people forget is that in the early 1990s in California, we had suffered half of the country's net job losses in that recession, partly because it was induced by a reduction in Cold War defense spending because of the end of the Cold War, and that rippled through our industrial structure. And that Rush Limbaugh began his talk radio career in Sacramento in the late 1980s. So California has had that sort of perfect stew of demographic anxiety, economic uncertainty, and profiteering from political polarization. And we seem to have come through the other side. So in many ways, it felt like it was important to understand what had happened in California and whether or not there was a path out for the nation as well.
And it seems as though your book is really a tale of two Californias, the old and the new, in a sense. I'm maybe oversimplifying that. But if we could look at what I would call the old, let's talk about the growth of California in those early years, good and bad, infrastructure, for example.
Well, it's interesting. It's almost like the old, the new, then the old again. Because really what happened was that in the 1940s and 50s and early 1960s, this was a state that was investing in infrastructure, roads and water supply. It was building housing in order to accommodate a growing population. And most significantly, it was investing in human capital through a massive spending. We were amongst the top 10 states in the United States in terms of our spending on K through 12 per student, but also a big investment in what was called the master plan, the articulation of the University of California, a state university system, and a community college system. All of that was kind of stitched together by an economy that was growing jobs in the middle, and it was also stitched together by a sort of social compact that actually was about welcoming the newcomer and really investing for the next generation. We begin the second chapter with a really interesting op-ed that appeared in the Los Angeles Times in the early 1990s by a guy named David Hayes Bautista, sort of talking about how is it that we can accommodate a population that is low educated, has really big families, seems like it's not going to be able to fit into a modern economy. Everybody thought he was talking about Mexicans and Central Americans, and he points out that he was really talking about Okies that arrived in California in the 40s and the 50s, and the state figured out a way to make the kinds of investments in infrastructure and human capital that would allow that generation of newcomers to succeed. California lost its way from that sort of period through a kind of set of reactions to the demographic changes. In many ways, California is trying to find its way back to a social compact that welcomes people, that invests in the next generation, and that tries to create the kind of discourse that we had in that early period. That was a period of quite bipartisan, with both Republican and Democratic legislators and governors sort of working together or sequentially to really build a better California for all.
You know, I had forgotten if I ever knew about Ronald Reagan's role as governor. I knew he was governor, of course, but what I didn't realize is that he was the governor that enacted the largest tax increase in the state of California. I suppose that speaks to this issue of how California was trying to bring it around.
Well, Reagan's rhetoric was always more fiery than his actions. And actually, when he first came in, thought he was going to be able to deal with the deficit through the usual conservative rhetoric around cutting spending, but he found out that he needed to increase taxes to be able to right the fiscal ship. Now, you know, it is important. I mean, he was the beginning of a dramatic conservative turn. You know, one of the things we uncover in the book as well is that while there's a lot of attention to Prop 13, which was the tax revolt in 1978 that took place in California, 15 years before 1964, California voters passed Prop 14. And Prop 14 was a proposition that was a counter to some state legislation that had been passed to get rid of racial discrimination in housing. And California voters said, oh, no, we don't want that. We want to be able to sell to who we want to sell. We want to be able to continue to discriminate in housing. That eventually got struck down 2 years later by the California Supreme Court, who pointed out that you can't really just, you know, rewrite discrimination back into state laws. But that was a sort of reaction to the changing demography of the state, more people wanting to get in on the California dream. And it's important to realize that's how Ronald Reagan really sort of ginned up his political career in California, was by being one of the faces of Prop 14 on the grounds of property rights. He sort of built on that sort of conservative momentum to run and win the governorship in 1966.
You talk about California's social compact and how it fell apart. I was surprised to learn that you think the genesis of that may have been the California right-wing element grew out of agriculture.
Well, we had long had very significant right-wing movement that was based with growers and more rural elements in California who were very concerned about big changes that happened in the 1930s. In the 1930s, the Great Depression devastated agricultural wages, partly because of low farm prices, but also because of a mass influx of folks from Oklahoma coming to work in the fields, a sort of grapes of wrath period. Real wages actually fell by about half in agriculture, and there was tremendous labor unrest, and that drove a lot of growers and agricultural interests to the right. And really what we're trying to do is to point out that the conservative elements in California didn't come out of nowhere. They really were based in both agriculture and in the sort of rising suburban elements that emerged as suburbia developed as well. So, you know, what's really significant, though, is that the sort of reaction against welcoming all actually began to happen as the state's demography began to diversify. The 1970s is the period in time in which the share of children, that is young people below the age of 18, that were people of color, that percentage share increased more in the 1970s than in any decade before, or actually any decade since. And as a result of that, you saw an older generation beginning to look at a younger generation, not see itself, and start to, in some ways, really pull the drawbridges up. To draw bridges that had always been key for people to be successful in California. One thing we talk a lot about in the book is the racial generation gap. That is the percentage of people above the age of 65 who are white compared to the percentage of people below the age of 18 who are kids of color. And that racial generation gap was growing in the 1970s and 1980s. It actually peaked in the 1990s in California, a period in which we passed what I mentioned before, the anti-immigrant Proposition 187, but also a series of other racial propositions that got rid of affirmative action and bilingual education and helped to step up the incarceration of Black and Brown youth. Since then, that racial generation gap has moderated and closed. But it is of note that the racial generation gap nationwide is actually peaking right now in this era of Trump and in this era of really pretty open appeals to white nationalism and concerns about the diversity of the country.
Well, I mentioned before we got on the air here that Lawrence Wright has a book out on Texas that is a perfect example of how this generation gap is changing, and it's bound to happen sooner or later, isn't it?
It is. And the campaign in Texas between Republican Ted Cruz and Democrat Beto O'Rourke actually speaks a little bit to some of the transformations that eventually happen in California. Because one of the things that happened in the 1990s as this kind of racial reaction grew and filtered its way into public policy is that community organizers and social movement builders began to realize that they needed to adopt a very different kind of politics, that they needed to go beyond talking to those who are already converted, who are already progressive, who are already on their side, and figure out a way to get the language that would not move to the middle, but actually move the middle, really captures people's imagination and bring them in on some more progressive ideas. They also realized that what they needed to do was to activate an electorate that had not been voting before. So in California, that took the form of what's called integrated voter engagement. And that sort of community organizing meets electoral politics. It's where you don't try to just touch the voter lightly at the time of an election, but you actually try to build deep connections between elections so that you can take new and occasional voters, the people who don't show up for midterms, for example, and get them to be much more loyal. The third thing I think that organizers in California realized is that you needed to have a geographic strategy, that you couldn't just, you needed to actually, of course, activate voters in some of the bigger, more liberal pockets of big cities, for example, but that you also needed to get into places like Orange County, that had been one of the homes of the John Birch Society and sort of one of the hearts of the modern American conservative movement. You needed to reach into an Orange County, into a San Diego, into inland California, and activate who you could activate there to be a little bit more progressive. It's striking that in 2016, Orange County, this bastion of right-wing conservative Republicanism, it was the first presidential election that Orange County had voted for a Democrat since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Striking change. Mm-hmm. What does this mean for what's going on in Texas right now? If you look at Beto O'Rourke's campaign, he's tried to use a very positive language. He almost never criticizes Ted Cruz, although God knows there's plenty that you could criticize about Ted Cruz. Instead, he's trying to move the middle. He's got a campaign which is trying to activate people who have never voted before or vote very occasionally, Hispanic voters, young voters, folks in rural areas. And he's tried to have a geographic strategy that reaches out everywhere. So I think the playbook of what California progressives have done to sort of, in some sense, capture the center of the debate and the center of the political momentum is something that I think folks in other states are looking at.
And you identify social movements as playing a key role, both the business class and the climate crisis. Could you touch on those?
Yes. Well, I think that one of the things is that when we think about the transformation of California from a state that was held up as having its own version of the American dream and sort of its glory days of the 50s and 60s to the tremendous racial divisions and tensions and slumping economy of the early 1990s. And then you look at California today, fifth largest economy in the world, attracts 50% of the country's venture capital. I was just in Arizona yesterday and people were talking about how a lot of their political figures say they don't want to become California. And I was scratching my head a little bit. I mean, who doesn't want to be the fifth largest economy, attracting 50% of the venture capital, finally raising wages at the bottom of the labor market, pretty harmonious racial relations, beginning to shrink our prison population and come up with more effective ways for people to police and for people to re-enter, working hard to integrate our immigrants, and with a budget surplus, which is leaving a rainy day fund for folks to figure out what is the next thing that we want to invest in. So it's been a really remarkable turnaround, but when it gets talked about, it's often talked about as though it was the act of, for example, Jerry Brown, the governor, coming in and being the wise old man returning from the political wilderness and righting the state. But really, a lot of it has been this set of social movement actors and community organizers that have changed the political calculus that's made it possible for Brown to do what he's done. For example, one of the ways in which he was able to help correct the budget was by putting a proposition on the ballot to raise taxes, primarily on wealthy people and a little bit in terms of sales tax. That was actually not Brown's original idea. He wanted to go very heavy on the sales tax, which is regressive, very light on the income tax because he thought he would lose business support. He was forced to go in a more progressive direction because of organizers who had come up with their own ballot proposition and it was polling better, and they promised to take it off the ballot if he would alter his. Similarly, a lot of the stuff that's gone on to make the state more welcoming with regard to immigrants is something that has been really forced upon the governor because the political political calculus changed because of organizers and because of the role of business, too, in looking at these issues of immigration. So one of the things that's been quite interesting, it's where you started with your question, has been watching what's happened to the business class in California. They were overwhelmingly in support of higher taxes. They might not want people interfering in their markets, but they definitely don't mind having the kind of tax system that can actually create the kind of cushions and securities so that people feel more secure in a changing economy. Similarly, they've been quite supportive of dealing with the climate and having the kinds of regulations that California's put in place to try to make sure that we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Is it because of their love of the climate? Perhaps. It's also because they know that you attract better employees when you can preserve the quality of life. And they know that if the state moves in this direction, it's going to create a first mover and lasting advantage for them in world markets as the rest of the world tries to go toward renewable energy, et cetera. And I think the last way in which business has been kind of an interesting part of this turnaround is if you're in one of these new dynamic industries, creative industries, information, biotechnology, you see the value of immigrant employees, and you know that your younger employees very much value diversity and very much value inclusion. And while they may not always get there in terms of their actions in their workforce, they know that they cannot take the kinds of stands that are going to alienate their workers. And so I think there's been a really interesting shift in the business class, and that's part of the story in California, too.
You refer to this loss of manufacturing in California and perhaps LA in particular as deindustrialization. Where does that stand today? Did any of that come back?
Well, we are seeing, as in the rest of the United States, some return of industry and manufacturing, much of it having to do with what's called advanced manufacturing. So stuff that's a bit more reliant on computers and more highly skilled workers. Our aerospace industry shrunk, but it's kind of at the size that it will be. We are seeing, though, some interesting phenomena. So, for example, and this speaks again to the thing we were just talking about, Los Angeles, long viewed as the capital of car culture and suburban sprawl, Los Angeles voters have taxed themselves to the tune of $160 billion over the next 40 to 50 years to improve roads, but mostly to lay out a new transit system that's got a lot of rail, subway, light rail, and buses. And, you know, one of the things that organizers realized is that if you're going to do that, you need to make sure that you generate good jobs, not just in the construction of the light rail, but also in the creation of the rail cars. And so with quite a bit of political work and leverage, there's been an agreement to bring some of that rail car manufacturing into Los Angeles County. We've decided to clean up the climate. That means the electrification of our buses. And so a Chinese company that makes electric buses has located a branch here in Los Angeles County in order to provide jobs locally for us to get a return on the dollars that we're spending on this transit system. So there's a return of that manufacturing, but I don't think that it's going to be as big as it ever was. And what that means is that we need to really rethink the kind of economy that we're going to have. We're going to have a high-tech information, creative industry economy accompanied by a service economy, because for every software engineer, there's an army of nannies and gardeners and food service workers that go along with that. And what that means is that you actually need to have an economic strategy that values both innovation and inclusion, that understands that it's key to have these high-end jobs, but there's no contradiction between that and raising the minimum wage to lift up the service sector or promoting unionization in the service sector so that people can defend their rights. And I think that that sort of sense that you can try multiple strategies at the same time is a little bit of what returning back to that earlier era of California, in which we had, for example, a Republican mayor of Los Angeles, Fletcher Bowen, responsible for implementing a lot of innovative New Deal policies, including the creation of public housing in Los Angeles. That sense that it's not just going right or going left, it's not just supporting business or supporting labor, it's trying to figure out how you pull it together to have an economy that works for everyone. That's the challenge for California. If we can get the discourse going, it's the challenge for the United States.
How much damage has Proposition 13 done, like right on down to 2018?
Proposition 13 was passed in 1978. And what Prop 13 does, for listeners who are not as intimately familiar with this as we in California are, is that it essentially took the property tax assessments and rolled them back to 1975 values from 1978, and then said as long as the property doesn't change hands, the tax assessment can't go up by more than 2% a year, and the property tax can't be more than 1% of the value. So it immediately blew a giant hole in local budgets, and that has continued to last ever since. I mean, it came out of an impulse of wanting to prevent older homeowners who might be on fixed income from not losing their houses because of increases in property taxes. But a problem that could have been fixed with a scalpel was instead addressed with a sledgehammer. Mm-hmm. And it really starved the state of fiscal resources and created a lot of inequities. I mean, it was an older and whiter generation that saw their tax assessments protected, even as a new, younger, and more diverse generation of homeowners was arriving, paying full price for houses and higher tax assessments than the older homeowners. It also created a sort of illusion that you could cut taxes without causing damage to the state, in part because of the way that Jerry Brown in his first term reacted to it was by taking the surplus that was there at the time and sort of backfilling the taxes that were lost so that people came under the illusion that you could cut taxes without cutting services. This is the illusion that Ronald Reagan brought when he went to the presidency, in which he cut taxes, promising that that wouldn't cut revenues, blew a gigantic hole in the deficit. It was the illusion that George W. Bush brought to the presidency in 2000, cut taxes, saying that the economy would grow and wouldn't create a gigantic deficit and a huge financial crisis and crash. And it's the illusion that that Donald Trump has brought as well. Cutting taxes was going to somehow rescue the economy. As we can see right now, the deficit is again skyrocketing. The debt is growing. The Treasury is borrowing more than ever. So I think one of the lasting damages was that. The other thing about this, which I think has been really interesting, and it may be addressed in the next couple of years, is that if you sell a house or I sell a house, it's pretty clear that we sold a house and the new owner is going to see the tax assessment rise in line with the market value of the house. But that's not so much the case with corporations, because a corporation can sell a property, but as long as it sells it to a group of investors so that no single investor has more than 50% of the property, then it's not officially a change of ownership in terms of someone acquiring a 50% stake. And if you don't acquire a 50% stake, then the tax assessment of the property doesn't rise to the official market value. One of the most famous cases of this is when Michael Dell of Dell Computers bought the Fairmont Hotel in Santa Monica. He was about to close the deal when he realized that his property tax assessment would go up in line with the price that he paid. So he backed out and came back in to buy it with his wife, him, and a third investor, which meant that nobody had more than a 50% share, so the tax assessment didn't rise. Corporations have been gaming this, and partly as a result, the share of property taxes that corporations and commercial and industrial property owners pay has fallen, while the share paid by residential property owners has increased. In 2020, there's going to be an initiative on the ballot to split the role and to make the commercial and industrial property owners actually pay full freight. That would bring in about another $11 billion a year to the state coffers, probably help with education and a number of other things that the state needs going forward. But it will also be very important politically. It's kind of a symbol of that era of California closing and a new era beginning.
Well, the midterms are behind us, but I wonder what it is in California politics we should be looking for when it comes to this resurgence that you're talking about.
A year ago, the governor and state legislature passed an increase in the gas tax to be able to improve roads and improve mass transit. We hadn't had a gas tax increase in, I think, nearly 20 years, and it's a pretty modest increase. But the GOP thought that putting this anti-tax measure on the ballot would drum up GOP voting interest. Turns out that hasn't worked, and it's probably going to go down. And that'll be interesting because it'll sort of really signal to the GOP that the playbook that they've thought worked in the past may not be working any longer. Certainly, fanning the flames of racial division don't work in California. And if this fear of higher taxes doesn't work, and it doesn't seem to work in the last couple of elections, that I think is a pretty important signal. You know, one of the things that all these Republicans voted for was the Trump tax bill. And one of the things the Trump tax bill did was limit state and local tax deductibility. So that's had a big impact on California, because if we can't write off our state taxes, we have pretty high state taxes, then we're winding up having to pay even more taxes to both the state and the federal government. This is a state that really values immigrants and would like to see immigration reform. You know, if you poll the state, very much concerned about that. This is a state, you know, bipartisan support. Arnold Schwarzenegger was our Republican governor who put in place a lot of this climate legislation, really wants to protect the environment. So you've got a series of Republican Congress people who have voted against protecting the environment, who have not taken a leadership on integrating immigrants, and have voted for a tax bill that hurts Californians. It's not clear they're representing the state, even if they might represent some political, more conservative political views in the state. And so you see some of these races where it's pretty progressive Democrats running against them. You see some of these races where it's pretty moderate Democrats, including former Republicans, running against them. That's the thing to watch for in the California elections.
Manuel Pastor, thank you very much for joining us at Reader's Corner, and thank you most of all for the book, State of Resistance, What Californians' Dizzying Descent and Remarkable Resurgence Mean for America's Future. Thanks for being with us today.
Been a pleasure talking with you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of Reader's Corner. Next week, we talk to Eli Saslow about his book, Rising Out of Hatred. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.